Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this podcast entitled Reinventing Global Health. The session today will be on the future of global health, the main healthcare challenge, systemically, prioritization. And since I am the creator of the podcast, the host, and now the guest, I think I have to introduce myself for those who don't know me. As far as my international experience and expertise, I was a student at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro and studied there in Portuguese. Also at Paris 6 University, where I studied in French, and the George Washington University, where I studied English, and these all were medical studies. I am a specialist in tropical diseases from Paris 6 University and emergency medicine from Paris 12 University. I was an assistant professor in public health at Paris 6 University and adjunct professor in medicine at the George Washington University. I worked in the pharmaceutical industry, and I have also a corporate background. I was the research director at Hoffman La Roche in Paris, in France. I was an expert medical director at Delagrange Drug Company in Paris, France. I was the director of international corporate affairs and business development at Stanford Hospital and Clinic. I was the director of the Stanford Health Promotion Network at Stanford University School of Medicine. I was the chief medical officer for Chevron, the oil company in Papua New Guinea. And I did locum tenens as corporate physician in Cameroon and China. My primary care physician experience includes the fact that I was the only European private primary care physician in Lagos, Nigeria, and I worked at a branch of the St. Francis Hospital. I was the first and only private primary care physician for about 10,000 people on the island of Lifu in New Caledonia, which is an archipelago in the Pacific Ocean. I was a private primary care physician in Singapore, and I worked first at Gleneagles Hospital and at Asia Medic, and I was the physician of reference for 16 embassies. And I did some locum tenens in France in a city called Mauvezin. So the presentation goals are to determine a core roadmap for actions that are feasible and applicable across the globe to reach maximum efficiency and efficacy in providing healthcare. And along the way, I will give food for thought to frame issues. And this presentation will be a little bit unusual because it will be from horizontal perspective. As you have seen, as I've said, I have a vast experience and expertise in healthcare across the globe. And that will be different from the usual presentations. We have more vertical and even sometimes siloed. So let's start by examining the global health and healthcare challenges. Let's take Africa as an example. Well, the biggest and huge challenge is that there are limited resources and that, in fact, demand surpasses supply in many instances, in many places, that there is insufficient infrastructure. For example, there's a lack of hospitals, clinics, transportation means, power supply, access to potable water, and others. There is insufficient healthcare manpower, not only doctors, but also nurses, healthcare givers, lab technicians, and many others. There is insufficient and unreliable funding. And the provision of healthcare in Africa depends for a large proportion on foreign assistance in many areas. If we take the example of the Clinton Foundation, in 2021, there was a 75% decrease in funds since Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. So when one faces multiple challenges, there is a requirement. And this requirement is prioritization. And in order to tackle this challenge, this huge challenge, I will take the analogy of a medical emergency department in a time of catastrophe, be it natural, like an earthquake, or man-made, like a terrorist attack. So what happens in an emergency department in a hospital when this happens? And doctors are confronted with the fact that demand exceeds supply. The first step of the process that takes place is to assess the data that are provided by the past medical history. Well, here is the event, the catastrophic event that took place, the history of the disease, for example, how long since the trauma occurred, the clinical exam and the test results that have been run as fast as possible. All this is analyzed, and then a triage takes place. And now different model of triages, for example, this one has 5 levels, going from level 5, which is non-urgent needs, and treatment is given when time permits, to level 1, which is immediate life-threatening situation, condition that needs immediate attention. So if we transfer this model to global health, what is the number one criterion that should be chosen to do the triage? I submit there should be a return on investment. So the return on investment has several dimensions. Of course, a medical dimension, individually and collectively, but also financial. And that includes medical costs and economic consequences. Societal aspect, political involvement, moral dimension, and personal implications. So let's take one concrete example. The first would be the choice between acute and chronic disease. And I will take 2 diseases to exemplify my point. Tetanus, which is an acute disease, and HIV/AIDS, which has turned into a chronic disease since the advent of antiretroviral medication, ARVs. So what is the panorama? What is the landscape with HIV/AIDS? Over 1 million people die per year in Africa from the disease. By the end of 2017, 15.3 million people were living with HIV in the African region and were accessing life-saving antiretroviral drugs. In 2018, there were 20.7 million people living with HIV, and that year, 470,000 died from AIDS-related diseases. When we look at the age distribution, we see that 57% of the people with HIV/AIDS are between 26 and 35 years of age, which is logical because it's mostly sexually transmitted diseases, and this is when people are most sexually active. Now, if we look at the cost of the treatment of HIV/AIDS, and this is a treatment for life, it varies greatly across Africa and ranges between about $700 a year in South Africa to about $300 a year in Zambia and about $175 in Malawi. And that includes all the costs, personnel, ARVs, labs, and other costs. Now, if we compare it to maternal and neonatal tetanus, it is responsible for about 110,000 deaths a year in the African region. And this is data given by WHO, the World Health Organization. The case fatality rate ranges from 80 to 100%. So it's highly lethal disease. But this is preventable by mother immunization. And this entails 3 vaccinations during pregnancy. And it gives a prevention for 10 years with a single booster every 10 years thereafter. The cost is, or was in 1999, 32 cents of a dollar. 32 cents. And in Nigeria, it varies between 30 cents and $1. In 2022, a study was made to study the vaccination coverage in East African countries. And the percentage of mothers vaccinated with protection of tetanus in rural area was 50.4%, which means that 1 out of 2 women was not protected by the vaccine against tetanus. And this varies according to countries. It goes from 36.90% in Ethiopia to 48.7% in Malawi, but it's all around 50%, close to 50%. And now let's do the math and the calculus. So let's take $300 on average for a year for HIV/AIDS treatment for one person. That equates to 900 doses of tetanus vaccine. And that means that with this treatment, 300 mothers would be fully vaccinated for 10 years. If the HIV/AIDS patient life expectancy is 70 years, which is what it is in Africa on average, 210,000 mothers would be fully vaccinated for 10 years. So you see the huge discrepancy between those numbers. And the question is, why is the choice not made in favor of the tetanus vaccination? Well, there are two types of answers. There are the local factors, and here I refer to factors I enumerated for triage criteria, and also global factors. And one prominent one is funding. Not the quantity, but the quality of the funding. Where does it go? Where does the money go? And we know that we have enough money, for example, for the vaccination. And we know, therefore, it's possible to eliminate maternal and neonatal tetanus from Africa in the short term by, number one, making it a real priority. Number two, diverting funds from the HIV/AIDS budget and by triaging patients and using this to request additional funds and boost the elimination of tetanus, neonatal and maternal tetanus altogether. Of course, it requires reorganizing public and global health. If we don't do that, and we have not done that, and we are now in this situation because of COVID-19, of the resurgence of historical diseases, and it's in the news. 28 October 2022, in the Guardian, global TB cases increased for the first time in 20 years. 30 September 2022, Reuters, cholera outbreaks surging worldwide, fatality cases rising. 2 August 2022, polio, once nearly eradicated, is rebounding. 30 July 2022, NPR, some parts of the world saw increases in HIV/AIDS cases. 7 December 2021 from Gavi, how COVID-19 led to devastating rises in malaria. The news from 2 August 2022 was from Bloomberg. Now, let's take a second concrete example. In this case, it won't be acute versus chronic disease, but it will be prevention versus cure. And I'll stick to the same disease, tetanus. For one treatment, and when it's available, and this is a big caveat, because in most regions of the world, it's not available because it requires very sophisticated and costly equipment. But in the United States, for children, it is 72 times the mean cost of a U.S. pediatric hospitalization. And in 2012, it was $11,143. So 72 times this amount for the treatment of a cholera case in a child. For adults, the hospital charges ranged from $22,229 to over $1 million, according to the CDC. Compare those huge numbers to one full vaccination for 10 years, which costs from between $1 and $3. So, of course, there are some conditions for success. But the first one would be to avoid bureaucratic mode of operation. And jokingly, I always said, why make it simple when it can be complicated? And the second one, which is the crucial one, is to be able to make the hard, difficult choices. So what are the solutions? Now that we've made this assessment, this evaluation, how do we get out of it? Well, the first one would be that instead of good health being number three on the UN Sustainable Development Goals, and there are 17 goals, which is, to me, a complete nonsense. Any organization that has 17 goals, there must be some priorities in those goals. They cannot be at the same level. So I propose the following approach. Make good health, the number one priority. And then adopt three values, answer to one need, have one urgency with two sub-priorities, one must, three strategies, and I have six suggestions. The three values are equity, which is in dismal state in many countries, as we have seen because of COVID-19. Solidarity, which is also in pitiful condition in many places. And liberty, knowing that in excess, individualism undermines the two others. One need, and this is a big item, an accepted and respected leadership that would provide a clear, realistic, and inspiring vision and show the direction. Presently, we don't have this. There is one urgency after the leader has been found, which is a general political consensus, which is indispensable to improve global health dramatically. Because, in my opinion, and I'm not alone, everything is politics. This was said by Thomas Mann, who was a German writer who won the Literature Nobel Prize. So if you look at the 17 UN Sustainable Development Goals, none of them is political per se. In contrast, if you want to reach the 17 goals, it depends very heavily on political decisions and measures. And in my opinion, this is the main reason for the multiple and successive global health failures from top to bottom over the years. Political agreement would give coherence to global health and increase its efficiency tremendously. And I believe it can be reached since health is a common human necessity and also interest. As a matter of fact, when you ask people who want to travel overseas, the people, the expatriates, as they are being called, when the company asks them, you know, what is your most important factor to relocate? They always said healthcare quality in the country where I'm going, especially if they have children. So what are those priorities? The two priorities are nutrition, education. Nutrition, it's obvious because without good nutrition, intellectual development, physical development are stunted. And education, because after nutrition, education is the first need of the people. This was said by Georges Danton, who was a French revolutionary during the French Revolution. But nowadays, we know that for a fact, because it's the gateway to economic development and poverty and hunger elimination. And this has been shown clearly to everybody by the four Asian tigers, which I think he started in the 80s. And this includes capacity building and stopping the brain drain. And if we look at Africa, there is one must. Since I was a medical student, nothing has changed. And this one must is for economic development. And economic development is the foundation, the basis upon which everything else is built, because we know it has, for example, a direct impact on healthcare and elimination of diseases. And this was shown by better housing resulting from the Industrial Revolution, where people didn't have to live on top of each other anymore because they had better houses, better apartments. So therefore, there were more distance between them, and that decreased the incidence and the prevalence of tuberculosis even before the advent of the specific drug, the antibiotics. So this must is erasing the African nation's debt, which has been constantly increasing and has reached unsustainable level for many countries. As a matter of fact, it blocks development because those African countries have, of course, except when there's oil involved and gas, they have very limited resources, and all of their money goes toward not reimbursing the debt, but the interest of the debt. So this creates a vicious circle. They cannot invest and create more wealth because all their money goes into paying the interest of the debt. And I believe that developing countries have several reasons to erase this debt. The first one is a moral reason, because of the drain and the suffering that has been caused by the slave trade and also colonization. The second reason would be that the way the decolonization process took place was hasty and haphazard. And that created a handicap, a tremendous handicap for those countries to govern themselves. And the third reason is the vicious circle that I just described. What would be the strategy? In my opinion, there are three strategies. The first one is a new approach that should tackle issues serially, one after another, and putting the vast majority of the resources on the urgency and the priorities and based on prevention. The second strategy is thinking locally and acting globally, which means scaling from bottom to top and not the opposite, not the decision being made from an office in Geneva on data that are not emanating from the ground, but in many cases in models, mathematical models, which many times have been flawed. So nothing better than boots on the ground. People have to be there present, and not only for stints or transient and sporadic missions, but live there. And my third strategy would be to consolidate global health into a new international structure that not only would issue recommendations, just like now, but also have implementation power. That will revolutionize the field in a positive and productive manner. So I have six suggestions. The first one is a merger between WHO, the World Health Organization, PAHO, which is the Pan-American Health Organization, UNICEF, and Red Cross. This is what corporations do. They acquire and merge. And that would trim down tremendously the red tape and the fat. In the same token, a grand-scale merger between the Global Health Department in U.S. colleges and universities. Every major college and university has a global health nowadays, or every, most of them. And there is a lot of redundancy, and there is a lot of financial waste, and many times competition instead of collaboration and silos. The second one would be in terms of mergers, would be the same for the NGOs. Nationally and internationally. I remember when I was in Singapore and there was the tsunami in Indonesia. The people who were there were telling me that there were 300 or more different NGOs with a flag, sometimes a flag with one or two people. That's it, coming from all over the world. What kind of efficiency do you get when you get this scattered kind of assistance? And there was no organization on the ground to direct or orient or whatever. All these people, they were left on their own because it was their own initiative. It was not structured. So my third suggestion is to create a structure that would be coordinating all global health initiatives, suprastructure, being international, not like WHO, completely different. Another minor one, but would save a lot of money, is drastically limit face-to-face congresses and conferences. We have seen it's possible thanks to COVID-19, and that would save millions of dollars. You know, hair fares, meals, ground transportation, and so on. My fifth suggestion, and that would be the consequence or maybe attached to this structure that coordinating all global health initiatives, would be the right to interfere in a nation for healthcare reasons. And some of these healthcare reasons would be a transmissible disease. And this would come from this superstructure that could take the shape of a global health blue helmet brigade. The blue helmet brigade, you know, when there is a conflict, when there is war, in order to maintain peace, the UN send blue helmet as a buffer between the adversaries, between the fighting sides. This number five. And my last one, and this is probably top of the list, is to recognize and have poverty as the number one risk factor for many diseases. And that goes back to my two priorities, which is nutrition, malnutrition or insufficient nutrition that results from poverty. But this is a risk factor for many diseases. And there's a long list, and I will not go through it right now. It's not the focus on this talk. But that would change the approach, that would change the vision and the mode of operation. So when I look at my own experience, and I look at the past and the future. I was a young doctor in 1979 when I heard and read the Alma-Ata. It's the name of a city in Kazakhstan, which is now called Almaty. Very nice city. I've been there. And the WHO declaration at that time. The promise was health for all in the year 2000. That was extremely motivating. That was really something that everybody could relate to. It was a fantastic vision. A lot of young doctors like me were enthused by it. Of course, this did not happen, but it was possible. It was possible then, and it's possible now, in the near future, if we make the right and hard choices. And the first one is to radically change global health. So as food for thought, I will say this. Be realistic. Ask for the impossible, which was a slogan in May 68 in France. Be realistic. Ask for the impossible. And stretch the limit of what is possible. As President Obama said, yes, we can. So my conclusion will be, with all the means that have been at our disposal for decades, in 2022, we should have eliminated cholera, malaria, meningitis, and HIV/AIDS, principally in Africa. It is an ignominy for the human race that we did not, and it reflects poorly on our level of consciousness, ability to organize, and degree of evolution. It is clear that global health was and still is a huge and convoluted nexus, wasting lives and treasury. And it's high time for it to be changed radically. I look at global health the way it should have been, the way it ought to be, and the way it can be. And I say, why and why not? And the goal is to go from reality to dream, which is a pessimistic angle, from reality to new reality, which is the optimistic angle. Thank you very much for your attention. And I will see you next time for the next session of Reinventing Global Health. You can go to my LinkedIn profile, and I have all my contacts there, including my email address, if you have any questions. Thank you very much.